Everybody, 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 everybody.
Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
My name is Eric, and I am here with Homestar Runner.
Oh, why?
I don't know why I'm so excited to talk about Homestar Runner. That didn't happen until about 10 seconds ago, and now it's all I want to talk about. I don't know why.
Homestar Runner, like us, is one of the champions of the internet, I think is why.
Well, between the two of us, there's at least one champion of the internet. I think I'm willing to go that far. We have two movies today. Only one involves Homestar Runner. It's really not the theme of the show at all.
Right.
But we have two movies about sort of oppressive, almost invasive environments.
Mm-hmm.
What are those movies?
It's Roman Polanski's Repulsion and Craig Zobel's Compliance.
We're going to spoil both of those. And I think we're going to get into them pretty immediately, unless you have something amazing to tell me.
I do, actually. So before I tell anybody any good news, since obviously nobody gives a shit.
Wait, chapters.
Yep.
Use the chapter skip. Apparently Michael's going to tell us something.
Well, last week I mentioned that I was cheating on Double Feature.
All right.
But I don't know if it's technically cheating. What's it called when you are fucking one person and then you go fuck another person so that more people come and fuck the first person? Advertising. So I started doing regular podcasts over on oneofus.net, which is a group of guys down here in Austin that used to be have a public access show.
Mm-hmm.
Before, you know, when that was still a thing, probably like in the 90s or 2000s.
Wayne's World. They did Wayne's World.
They did Wayne's World.
Not actually. Did they actually do Wayne's World?
No.
Okay, just wanted to get that clear. It was not Wayne's World, but perhaps a right. different.
But they do. They have a ton of podcasts over there. They have specifically one called Highly Suspect Reviews, where we talk about new movies that aren't out or are just coming out. And I'm doing that with them. I'm also probably going to get involved with their music podcast, apparently.
So you have like a long term polyamory type thing going on here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just kind of shouting Double Feature in another place on the internet, I think is really the makeup of what's going on.
That's good.
And actually there's a third place now where I can shout Double Feature, which is this, because of oneofus.net, I get to be one of those assholes that sees movies before other people.
Oh, I see what this is. This is like a money laundering scheme.
Right.
This is like a screener laundering scheme. Okay. So you have people can't see my air quotes. I'm not even going to do them and just tell people I am. You have a storefront. You have a laundromat,
right,
that people should totally go to. What is it?
It's unratedfilms.tumblr.com, which is just, I mean, it's just a really...
Which is your totally official movie review blog. Right. Is what right. that is.
It's just, I mean, it's just your basic, these movies are coming out blog with the very specific bent of, I don't say whether or not they're good or bad, kind of adopt the exact same thing we do here on Double Feature, which is champion every film we cover, talk about all its good points, and then basically just create a list of things that if you like this movie, you might like, you know, the film being reviewed, or if you like this actor, or if you like Daddy Issues, you might like The Judge.
right.
So, I mean, I guess that it feels good because I was kind of lost here in Texas, but apparently I get to just do Double Feature all the time.
That works out really well for me.
Speaking of which, I think we have two movies to cover, and without further ado, allow me to repulse you.
Can that be your first and last repulsion joke on this show?
Am I going to be inundated? No, it's okay.
With all of those? Repulsion is one of Shella Sapgrove's favorite films. She gave to our Kickstarter this year.
Mm.
Big Roman Polanski chick. And we'd actually covered one of the other Polanski films in this sort of apartment trilogy.
Rosemary's Baby.
the sort of loose collection with The Tenant, mm-hmm. which kind of makes me think a little bit about the style of this, because that's one of my favorite parts of it is the actual apartment that we're in the entire time. Mm-hmm. Reminds me a lot of a Chicago apartment. I know it's a Paris apartment or whatever, but
it's fine.
I think maybe just the kind of places that you and I have lived.
Yeah.
Some of your apartments remind me of this one too.
Yeah.
You know what it is? The fucking, the mysterious piano scales that just come from somewhere in the building. You don't really never know who here plays the piano or how many people actually live here. But just at some point throughout the day, I did live in that place. Yeah, right? Isn't that?
Yeah.
We used to record in those places.
Yeah, totally.
In fact, I think the first two or three years of our shows have, you know, mysterious piano scales in the background.
Sure.
But other than that, it's a really quiet kind of apartment. The whole film is quiet. You have that sound of the ticking clock that'll happen between that and the piano scales. I mean, I think the audio, like much of the film, is meant to drive the audience completely fucking insane.
Yeah.
Which it does a pretty good job of doing.
Absolutely. Even the larger score bursts when there's something more dramatic going on, namely murder.
Oh, yeah.
The snare triplets at a volume way higher than the rest of the film plays.
I almost want to call them orchestra hits.
Yeah.
They're so, I mean, let's just bring the entirety in for one fucking
deafening.
You know what I mean? It's just one shrill. Yeah, it's good. The sound isn't the only thing that's ambitious. I actually think the visual component, specifically the motion of the camera, man, to use a word like ambitious almost seems to undersell it.
Yeah.
You remember when we did Rocky, we talked about the first film that had used a Steadicam and how nobody used that before. I don't actually know where, Repulsion's what, mid-60s?
Yeah, 65.
I don't actually know where in the development of camera equipment, portability of cameras, size of camera rigs, and so forth this was. But it's also really early for Polanski. It's right. The first of the Apartment trilogy. It's one of his first films, I think.
It is. It's his second film.
Awesome.
It's his first English-speaking film,
sure.
Nonetheless.
There's so much moving camera in this. A lot of specifically pans. Mm-hmm. You know, the camera will be in one place. I guess I should say both. Both happen. The camera will be in one place and jerk to another place or follow movement within the frame. And at other times, it'll start on peeling potatoes and the entire camera will move back a couple feet, you know, up and over sort of the movement of a little hill and come back to the second composition. So you'll start composed on, here we are, potato, you know, however you're rule of thirds or whatever you're doing with your shot there, and know that you have to move the camera, maybe not be terribly concerned about how the movement goes,
right,
but move the camera to land back on what is entirely another setup. Mm-hmm. And what makes me think it's really ambitious, or, you know, looking at it and kind of going, I don't even know if people were doing this back then, is how much I can feel the physical labor of moving that camera.
Right.
It shakes and it kind of jerks into place. And there's a lot of spots where, I mean, if you were to film it like that today, you wouldn't use those takes. Mm-hmm. They would be unusable because of how jerky the
right.
motion is. But I think it was such a new thing then that, you know, they were just barely getting away with these kind of movements. And the fact that they're shaky and a little messed up also adds to the jarring nature of the film. It's not something outside of what you would expect for the tone of the movie. You know, it's a film that starts on a giant eyeball reading the credits. The eyeball's reading the credits, right? That is what's happening in the I can't tell if it's looking at each.
I don't think so.
Well, the credits are kind of flying around and it looks like the eyes sort of follow.
I'm not going to have another breaking the fourth wall argument with you. Suffice to say, my opinion is on the other side of M this time.
You would agree, though, that this is a really great companion to the Rocky Horror Lips credit opening,
right? Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
I think that that with a little bit of labor and a labor of love, it would truly be, we might be able to build some sort of cult film art installation where you stack X amount of tube TVs that make a face over the intro
you
credits.
You mean May style. You're talking about
right.
May.
but then you play them all during their respective scenes.
Sure.
And see if Dark Side of the Moon style, Dark Side of the Rainbow.
This is actually a really good idea. Yeah.
They actually make some sort of weird pink. Maybe they all play Wish You Were Here.
I don't really know what the point of that installation would be, but that doesn't really stop most artists who have a...
Dibs on that installation.
All right. So yeah, we've been talking a lot about the style of the movie. I'm passionate about that. I think it's a really good... I like the way it feels.
Mm-hmm.
But really, if you're going to talk about Repulsion, I think you have to talk about Carol. I think that's where the bulk of the conversation really is.
I think the best way to describe Carol is she is the character who embodies the title of the film.
Mm-hmm.
She has a serious problem with intimacy, men, sex, people, going outside.
Sure. Right.
Doing anything.
Right.
She's basically averted to, I don't want to say she's averted to life because, you know, to each their own, but she's certainly averted to the normal human existence.
Right.
In more ways than one would necessarily say was healthy.
Sure.
She's not the kind of roommate that's going to say congratulations when she hears you having sex.
Right.
You know, the next morning they see you and go, hey, congratulations.
Sure, sure.
She's the kind of roommate that's going to knock on your door and ask you to please quiet down.
If she's not too skittish to even go knock on your door.
Right.
I shouldn't say skittish. I mean, this is... So the movie is a portrait of a disturbed individual.
Mm-hmm. A serial killer.
Yeah, right, right. And I think any movie that's about a person who's committing killings is something of a portrait of a disturbed person. Obviously, I keep using the word portrait. I'm thinking Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of French films. Man Bites Dog.
Yep.
Which a lot of people reference, you know, when you try to talk to them about Behind the Mask instead.
Yeah.
France was really into that follow around the serial killer, do different things with the serial killer. They were doing a lot of really interesting movies around serial killers before we took it to exploitation and splat.
Right.
And Repulsion is, you know, looking at the fact that we have a person who is a victim in some sense, or at least we're sympathetic to.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a huge piece. Which also reminds me of the Man Bites Dog thing a little bit.
Right.
You know, we're following them and I think we're supposed to feel for Carol. I think.
I think so too. Right? Yeah, absolutely.
I do.
Yeah.
So it works whether it's supposed to or not.
Yeah.
We talked about this film a little bit and you had mentioned Miss 45.
Yeah.
Which I think has to be largely inspired by Repulsion or a huge fucking coincidence.
Well,
you know what I mean?
I think what's really interesting about Repulsion and Miss 45 is not necessarily their similarities, but their differences.
I'd agree with that.
I mean, there's no question that they if you were to water down the plot to its most basic five sentence theme, they would basically be the same movie. However, right. Miss 45 gives you motive. It's a lot more violent. It's definitely more exploitative.
I don't want to assume everybody has seen Miss 45, by the way. It's a 80s film by Abel Ferrara that we covered on the show. But, you know, it's a young woman who's hounded by men and begins to exact her revenge
right.
in a pretty relentless manner.
Right.
Who's also mute and in some ways sympathetic in that film too.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's definitely in that way kind of similar to Repulsion. But I think that you and I, when we covered that show, found the morality questionable.
Sure.
Not to say that you and I totally think Carol's in the right in Repulsion,
mm-hmm.
but I think that it's a little bit clearer. Conversely, I think I'm more on Carol's side, even though I think what she's doing is actually more wrong than Miss 45. And it's hard to say that any level of violence toward another human being is more or less wrong.
Right.
I mean, I think it's pretty black and white in that regard, but if you want to take it to court, self-defense and crimes of passion will alleviate your sentence more than, he touched me, so I killed him.
Yeah, well, we're talking about exploitation in the 80s.
Sure.
So, you know, we're not in the same place. But I do think looking at these two films together would be a really interesting exercise
mm-hmm.
to see a little bit of our reaction. I mean, how much better an example could you have gotten than an 80s Abel Ferrara film to, as a point of comparison between these two? I think Carol's actually so sympathetic that when I watch Repulsion, I find myself saying, well, yeah, but this could be viewed that it's in her head.
Yeah.
Until the end.
Sure.
And then I get to the end and I go, no, there's the movie's not even trying to do that. But as I watch it, I keep thinking this is because she's going nuts, right?
Well, I think that there's definitely the parallel of the house breaking,
yeah,
falling apart. I think that is more symbolic than literal. And obviously the Freddy hands coming out of the wall,
right,
a technique mastered 20 years before Wes Craven took it to the next level.
Good job, Roman Polanski. Good job.
But yeah, I mean, I was in the same boat as you. I kind of figured this is probably more of a psychological breakdown than it is a murder spree.
Sure.
And I was wrong. It's just a murder spree. It's both, but it's in fact totally a murder spree.
Even having been decades and decades ago, I'm surprised people don't steal from Repulsion more.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the way it shows things like the you know, the more recent fascination with unreliable narrator or unreliable plot in movie, I guess.
Right. Unreliable writer is what that's called.
Thank you. That's, yeah. You know what I'm talking about though, right?
Yeah.
Where a movie's going one way and then, whoa, what the fuck is happening? Oh, it was a lie the whole time. You didn't realize this or that or this.
Sure.
We could reference, I mean, thousands of these. We could do a whole fucking show where we just name movies that are, that have twist endings or try to teach you the movie is one way and then it's another. I can think of a favorite movie of both of ours that has a big gag at the end about twist ending that turns out to actually not really be a thing. But nobody is stealing Repulsion's awesome method of being totally fucking oblivious that that's even an option, you know?
Yeah.
It moves from place to place as far as the representation of her crazy. You know, when we first see her being nuts, what the movie does is something that I feel like has never fucking been done ever, which is we show a person's tics from the outside instead of that place movies want to go, which is how does it look through their eyes?
Right.
We see her kind of stare off and, you know, we'll be standing in the doorway as the camera,
mm-hmm,
and we'll be watching her kind of stare off or fuck with a chair or just kind of seeing bugs or whatever we speculate might be going on in her head. But we are watching as a normal audience, as a normal person, we're looking at somebody and seeing their insanity from the outside, from the point of view of somebody who is still very sane.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of hoping the movie would do that the entire time, but I think eventually bringing you through to what it looks like for her and pulling you in and out of that and giving you other vantage points makes you question the reality of the movie unnecessarily, thus adding an entire layer that might not even be there,
yeah,
of is this happening or not? Because you're trained to think the movie is showing you reality as it actually is, not as it's perceived through the lens of a nut job. And so when you start seeing hands come out of the wall, you just go, well, I guess there's actually hands coming out of the wall. Wait a second, that can't be. Oh, well, that must mean the murders aren't real. And you kind of go back and forth on that. And it's a more interesting way, I think, to draw the audience into feeling crazy themselves.
Sure.
Because then they're actually questioning the reality.
Well, and I think it's also important in cinema now, you get this constant thing where if a crazy person turns out to be crazy, the film discounts everything they've seen as if that character has been sitting in a chair with their hands folded for the entire film. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where you go, oh, turns out they're crazy. What a twist. And you rewind to,
therefore there's nothing.
Yeah. Therefore they've not done anything for this entire movie because of ripple effects, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have to castrate the character from the beginning. Otherwise, even everyday things they do may have caused some negative, positive, whatever effect. And I think it's important to look at Repulsion as a study of crazy people are people too.
Sure.
And they go through their day and sometimes they see hands come out of the wall and they go, that's, I don't like seeing that, but I can probably understand that that's not real.
Right.
But the line becomes a lot more blurred when they go, "Ah, I don't like getting raped, but I don't think this is real. This feels just as scary to me."
Sure.
As those hands,
sure.
The fear is at the same level, no matter whether or not it's really happening. And so when a crazy person kills a person, that's where you get pleas of insanity, because the reality of that is sometimes they don't know where the reality of that is.
Well, and to have the audience question that, you know, the best way to do that might be to make some things real and some things
exactly.
not. I mean, it seems so obvious when you just say it like that, but movies don't do that. They right. don't really have you question reality. They give you a bunch of lies and then later tell you if they're all collectively true or not. The idea of questioning is you don't know on a case-per-case basis what's real and what isn't. And what better way to do that than show you some real things, very tangibly, some sort of in the middle things, and then some things that are definitely not fucking happening. I don't know today how much of her house is crumbling. I don't know, you know, if she was raped through the course of the movie.
Yep.
I have pretty strong guesses about those things, but they're left in a more, they're left while I'm spinning of dementia from having watched the film.
Sure.
While I'm just hanging out in my apartment trying to be okay. And all of a sudden the house is crumbling and there's orchestra stabs happening.
Well, and it's another really strong move on the subject of questioning. I think that Polanski doesn't spell out why she is this way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if the film spells out why Carol is fucked up, why she has this problem with men, sex, and the world, I think wrongly, but entirely, you and I would start to form an opinion on whether or not she's allowed to be that way. And I don't mean you and I as Eric and Michael. I mean you and I as me and the audience.
Yeah.
I think that if we see something terribly fucked up happen at the beginning of her life to cause this, a la Ms. 45, our level of sympathy may raise or fall as her actions progress.
Right.
We go, okay, listen, you're outweighing the bad thing that happened to you now.
Right.
Or the other way, we might go, oh no, you're totally justified. Because I mean, here's the options, right? She could have been molested by a father or uncle or something.
Right.
Which the film maybe points to with the image at the very end of the film.
A lot of people feel really strongly about that, but I don't.
I don't feel strongly.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm acknowledging the inclusion of the image.
Right. Okay.
But again, something like that, you go, okay, that's terrible, but it doesn't outweigh what you're doing to people.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if just before in the previous moments of the film, we watch all the people who she kills chain her up and gang rape her and then throw her back in the apartment,
right.
Then vengeance becomes a little bit more tolerable sure. as an audience. And we go, yeah, get those fuckers. But by leaving it out, what I'm going to say is entirely, but I guess you have heard that people believe maybe not so much. I think it allows us to form our own opinions on Carol based on how people treat her, which is as a human being, as a person that people at least want to get close to, right? She's not disgusting.
Right.
She at least keeps up personal hygiene. She's a pretty girl. So in that way, it's a lot easier for you to take the character at face value
sure.
as opposed to start forming opinions based on what may have happened to her prior to the opening of the film.
Well, and there's another element that has kind of been omitted from our conversation, which I think could fill a conversation in its own, but she's hounded. She is catcalled.
Oh yeah.
People are giving her unwanted sexual advances. And I also think this is something that even just in the time since we've covered Miss 45, because that movie's a lot more about that.
Oh, yeah.
But we didn't talk about it a lot there either. Just in the years since this, there's been a hyper awareness of this
sure.
around both the skepticism group and the gaming group, mm-hmm. which are two things I follow on Twitter. So, you know, I didn't want to get in a whole gossipy thing about it because I think largely that's what those conversations are.
Uh-huh.
But you have these things that end in hashtag gate all the time.
Sure.
That are around, you know, the newest evolution of feminism. And I think in a lot of ways, for many people having that conversation, repulsion is an interesting anecdote and maybe even something of a battle cry.
Sure.
You see a woman who's gone. I keep using the word insane. I mean, you know what I mean by that, right? I don't need to be more subtle or
right.
She's gone a little crazy. And we see her hounded all the time. And I think some people could look at that and go, a victim of abuse or a victim of society and the things that they do in reaction to that. I don't know how much I go to this movie for that either, although I could totally see people going there for it. But I just like seeing such a portrait of a person who has these problems in their head, that hears insects, and that, you know, watching them decay like a fucking disgusting rabbit meal sitting out in their living room, and giving the, not the benefit of the doubt, but giving this kind of thought to representation of that person. Above all things, I think Repulsion is a movie about how Carol feels.
Yeah.
And getting the audience to identify with that a little bit, even if they don't agree or are uncomfortable by it, which may also kind of be the point. I don't think we see enough movie. It almost reminds me of Absentia, we were talking about the other day.
Yeah.
Or weeks and weeks ago at this point. I've been thinking about Absentia a lot since we covered that. But getting somebody to kind of identify with the character and the emotional place they're in, and then using the horror, the terror of the movie to show the audience what that's really like.
Right.
And for the terror to be so fucking effective. I mean, until the first scare, I'm just hanging out. Everything's fine in this movie. Just watching a little cute beatnik 60s French whatever. And then the fucking, you know, the mirror happens, and it's just, it completely gets me that first, you know, put the mirror back. There's a dude hanging out in the background.
Yeah.
This movie goes full on with the scare shots. I mean, in a way that almost wants me to point at it and go landmark and pioneering scare shots.
Sure.
They're full on. You have sight gags. You have a fucking mirror. You have these music flourishes.
Yeah.
The reality of the film is warping in a way that you don't expect to be possible. So that's catching you off guard. And once you start being terrorized, I think it makes you a little skittish. It makes you come along with the character. Now we can kind of see what she's going through. And in a way, when she starts killing people, I almost get this feeling like, yeah, the sketchy landlord came over. He was being a sleazeball. Hands might come out of the walls at any point. We got to just end this guy's life so that we have enough problems to deal with right now.
Okay. So homestarrunner.com is one of the most important things that's ever happened on the internet. It's something, I guess what it happened. Shit. I must've been a freshman in high school. So
2000, it actually started the new millennium.
Okay. All right. Well, it's a comedy cartoon website. There are pieces of Homestar Runner that have thoroughly saturated the internet.
It's what we did on the internet before memes. I think that's what Homestar Runner was.
Trogdor, the Burninator, is what we did on the internet before memes. And it went dark for 4 years, 4 years ago. And very recently, they brought it back online with a video that I sent you recently. Fisheye lenses, which is perfect for double feature.
Now, I didn't know there was a compliance and Homestar Runner connection.
Oh, yeah.
I had seen the Homestar Runner news, but I didn't know. I've seen compliance a couple times.
Uh-huh.
I just never knew that. That's real. So how are these things related?
Craig Zobel, the director of compliance, writer-director, co-writer-director at least, is one of two or three guys who create and run Homestar Runner.
Yeah.
Very possibly some of the voices on homestarrunner.com.
I think he's a creator, and then the other two are
The voices.
I think it was him and the two Chapmans.
Right.
And they were the creators, and then the Chapmans write it.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know what his involvement is. This is all very new to me.
What it really manages to do, knowing that he was involved in Homestar Runner, or is make compliance a lot darker.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like John Stewart doing Rosewater.
Sure.
It feels a lot more grave when somebody you're well known with for being utterly silly and completely just likable and amusing finds grounds to go, okay, but we need to talk about something very seriously.
Right.
Suddenly all the fun is sucked out of the room.
Yeah, I call that Stephen Banks syndrome.
Yeah.
Where you have a little SpongeBob, but then you have Billy the Mime.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It just makes Billy the Mime way fucking darker. Yeah, it is a dark movie, Compliance. It is gut punch after fucking gut punch. And you know, you have to wonder when the strip search comes that early in the movie where it's going to go. I mean, that was, that's the first thing that happens. And the fact it happens so early, I go, wow, this is going to be a pretty fucking dark ride.
Yeah.
The first time I saw Compliance, I didn't know if we were going to do, you know, multiple stories or because we get to that so quickly. And the fact that it is so infuriating and so drawn out really is, I think, one of, I go back and forth on this, but I think it's one of the strengths of the movie.
I definitely think it's making a point. Regardless of whether or not it's a strength of the film itself, I think that the point that they're driving home in Compliance is that in reality, this took place over a whole day. I mean, 8 to 10 hours, I think.
Mm.
I mean, in the amount of time, I know that there was some 4 hour period of time where she was in the room alone with the fiance.
Yeah.
And they obviously don't reflect that directly in the film. But I think the point is to say that we're sitting there going, this seems awfully drawn out. Is there going to be anybody with the sense to know that this is probably not okay? When in reality, the event that this is based on took 6 times this amount of time. And that,
oh, I know.
That poor girl was sitting there much longer than the uncomfortable audiences for the entirety of Compliance.
It's such an unbelievable story to the point where, I mean, I love Compliance now, but it made me really angry the first time I saw it because I was so skeptical about it. I went, you know, especially as a fucking humanist.
Sure.
I went, there's no way that you can convince me that this actually happened like this.
Right.
Something has to be played up or something has to be distorted. And it almost seems like for reasons of theatricality, they have to make it less bad than
right.
it was. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's really interesting too, because I'm totally with you. I'm sitting there the whole time trying really hard not to blame Sandra, but honestly seeing her as the locomotion for this.
Oh, we'll get to that.
I mean,
don't worry. I want to ask you about 1,000 things about that.
Well, and it's really interesting too, because if you do some research on the internet about this event, it constantly points you towards 2 experiments. It's the Milgram experiment and the Stanford Prison Experiment, which are both exercises in authority. And the Milgram experiment, I'm pretty sure people have probably heard of. In this experiment, there's an experiment guy. then there's, I mean, like I can't remember the exact words. I remember the diagram of ET. What is it? ETL. E is examiner, T is teacher, and L is learner, or something like that. And the examiner is a person in charge of the experiment. The teacher is actually the subject of the experiment. And the learner is a confederate in the experiment who pretends that they are also the subject of the experiment, but are actually part of the experiment themselves. And the whole idea is that the examiner asks questions to the learner. If the learner gets them wrong, the teacher has to shock them with electricity, an obviously painful amount of electricity.
Sure.
And the experiment is to understand if a human being will knowingly administer pain to somebody because somebody that they believe is an authority figure keeps telling them to.
Right.
How far they're willing to take hurting another human being under orders of an authority when they feel there's no repercussions. Stanford Prison Experiment is fairly similar in that it's basically a mock prison setup where people are given the role of guard and people are given the role of prisoner, and it's an experiment to see how quickly those roles affect the person's mentality, wherein the guards suddenly would punish prisoners for doing things. They would take prisoners and have them administer punishment to other prisoners. Meanwhile, the prisoners are all acting completely subservient, like they've deserved or earned this, like they need to play up to the guards. And furthermore, in that experiment, the person putting it on, who filled the role of the warden, noted later on that he was just letting it all happen because he felt sure. like he was the first authority to tell them when to stop. And for him, nobody was, he didn't have to answer to anybody. So as awful as it sounds, you can't just blame Sandra for something that seems devastatingly inherent in human beings, at least through experimentation.
Yeah, and this might be the best place to talk about that, because once we have this idea of these experiments loaded in our head, I actually feel like maybe this is a good shortcut for us.
Yeah.
It helps answer a lot of these questions that honestly, I've never felt better about the way I feel about them as right now, after having just, you know, kind of put it in that context. I think the movie might be positioning this as Sandra's blame.
Yeah.
Especially given the end and
sure.
her sort of Sarah Palin-esque interview that mm-hmm. she does. You know, that's narrative power, because I come away at the end of the movie feeling like, oh yeah, well, obviously it's her fault, but I never feel that way as it's happening, especially in the beginning.
Right.
Furthermore, I'm terrified knowing how easy it is for this to accidentally happen using some psychology.
Right.
You can imagine being in a spot. It also doesn't hurt that, you know, they're at this fucking chicken shack and they're all making sandwiches and they're really busy. They're down a couple people. There's hectic stuff happening in their lives. I feel like this is another experiment waiting to happen. I feel like just making people this busy, there's a like a mental part of your brain that just shuts off.
Sure.
The one that's responsible for allocating time for decisions that need to be made,
mm-hmm.
where you just go, oh yeah, there's a thing happening in the back room. I don't really have time for that right now. This is on fire. We're out of pickles. And I feel like one of Sandra's greatest faults, which is also something that I think I could be caught doing the easiest in this film, is not dedicating the right amount of time or attention to this thing that's happening. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you and I both run ourselves pretty thin
yeah.
at different points in the year.
Yeah.
Especially with this show and now with your 50 new podcasts, you know, jobs and moving and I don't know, social anxiety or whatever. We end up with less time than humans really need to do the things that we're doing.
Right.
And I know those are the points where, you know, we put together the worst shows, which thankfully can be fixed in post and are helped out a little bit by our enormous amount of scheduling.
Uh-huh.
But I don't, you know, I just don't dedicate time to things in my life that I really should.
Uh-huh.
And I see that happening to people around me too. You get busy, stuff's going on. You decided something was a priority or you're already involved in it. Or, you know, it's your job. And then when you have that combined with these experiments you're talking about, where a voice of authority comes in and says, well, this isn't, you know, this is my jurisdiction. This is my job. And I'm going to need you to commit to doing this one thing. Just say yes. And she says yes. And from there, you know, in the room, the person who is in charge of what's happening is Pat Healy's character.
Right.
He's the caller. That's obviously, I mean, he shouldn't. He has no actual authority. It's a prank. Even using the word prank doesn't feel right.
Right.
It's a crime. That's uh-huh. It's a lie that's happening. But in her head, as she gets busier and busier and more people ask things of her and she gets spread thinner, she goes, well, that guy on the phone, he's the one really in charge. And he said it's okay to put this guy in the room and I'm helping out. And
sure.
Oh, look, another burger's on fire. Let me run over here. And frantically, you're going from place to place. You don't consider it very much.
Right.
I don't know if that's to say she shouldn't be partially accountable, or I'm less interested in who do you point the blame finger at, because I don't feel like I'm qualified to know that. But I am terrified seeing her character and going, wow, I get pretty busy sometimes. I hope I wouldn't let like a poor human being get raped in the back room of mm-hmm. a McDonald's.
I think we see a lot of films that highlight failures in the Justice Department, bad sentencing, criminals getting off, all this stuff. I feel like in the case of the real Mount Washington story, So Compliance is a film that is verbatim this story that happened in Mount Washington, or somebody wrote the plot of Compliance under the Mount Washington heading on Wikipedia, right. Whichever came first. And I think what's most interesting about this story is that when you read what happened to the characters, unfortunately, aside from Becky, the character Becky in reality ends up, I mean, she's just, it's terrible. It's an awful, awful, awful thing. And I mean, the film doesn't pull that punch. She's hands down just being used, abused, molested this whole time. I mean, her humanity is stripped with her clothing and it's out in Sandra's car. I mean, it's...
Yeah, and I don't think there's really any blame to place on her.
Not at all.
Even the fact that... So that cop asks her at the end, the detective goes, so when this started happening, why didn't you say no? And I think that's not there to go, you should have said no. It's there because the entire audience had, they know the end outcome.
Right.
They're not really there in the moment. They're there after the fact, analyzing the situation,
mm-hmm.
and they want the answer to that question.
Right.
I think that's the only reason it's asked.
Well, it also, that interestingly also came up in her lawsuit against McDonald's, that she should have known better than to do it. Total bullshit.
That's fucking ridiculous.
I mean, she...
That's just absurd.
She won an amount of money, not the amount she sued for. But you're right. It's totally garbage. But if you look at the three people who I think we can agree are at varying degrees of fault here,
mm-hmm.
honestly...
And also victimhood, right, which is a weird thing.
Sure.
I would say fault and victimhood.
So Sandra, her fiance, and the caller, I think, are the three people that we can agree are in varying degrees of, like you said, fault and victimhood. The caller ended up getting acquitted after his arrest. And, you know, that fucking sucks. But the fiance ends up getting 5 years in prison for sexual assault. And Sandra got a very short 1 year probation and obviously fired from McDonald's. Because believe it or not, McDonald's has a don't strip search your employees clause in their employee handbook. For real, that's in there.
Yeah.
Also, don't let non-McDonald's employees into the back room.
Right.
So she broke both of those. She got canned. And I think you're right. I think Compliance does try to pin all this on Sandra, which I can understand why. And it's that Sandra allows it to happen. She is the, again, like I said, the locomotive, the driving force to try to make sure to appease this police officer for whatever reason. But if we go back and look at the Milgram experiment and the Stanford prison experiment, it's unfortunately not unheard of in human nature. If we're to believe through the scientific method that this is exemplary of human nature and not the subjects at question, that the caller somehow exploited a part of the human, or at least the American, submission to authority.
Mm-hmm.
We're taught at a very young age that police officers are your friend. Do whatever the police officer says. If you're in trouble, ask a cop. He'll tell you what's going on. I mean, we're taught at a very young age to respect and obey the police force here, and then basically spend the rest of our lives learning varying degrees of fuck the police.
Right, right.
But I don't think that you can get that out of a person. I think that when a cop is on the phone telling you, you are now an extension of my arm of the law.
Right.
You end up with Sheriff Wydell syndrome from The Devil's Rejects, where you feel, I am the arm of justice because without me, justice cannot reach this jurisdiction. And so when justice is speaking to me, you see where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
When justice is speaking to me, it is all I can do to be its vessel and make sure what I hear gets done on this earth.
Wow, that got a little, let's say, preachy at the end there, huh?
I mean, there's an analogy to be drawn, I think.
I don't know if the movie is 100% in the it's all Sandra's fault camp. There's also narrative quality to that.
Sure,
there is,
sure.
You know, our ending and trying to pick up the pieces and figure out who the fuck. I think one of the large things that the newsroom turned me on to was the concept of institutional failure.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, a company allowing somebody to become so thinly spread that they can't make good decisions combined with poor training. It's an avenue that's not very explored in compliance, but one where my head kind of goes. Also, Pat Healy's character. I mean, come on, as the
obviously
one who instituted,
the bad guy.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
obviously the bad guy.
There's a tricky thing you have to do with Sandra because you have to, I think, separate, and this is true of her fiance too. You have to separate her fault and her victimhood. Because if you can ignore for a fact, let's just say 100% fucking guilty, terrible human being. If we can take all that and put it in a box and push it to the side a little bit. Okay, yeah, we all get that Sandra's a bad person. She made mistakes. She's horrible. Let's just say we agree with that for a minute, which I don't.
Right.
But let's just say we do.
Mm-hmm.
So we take all that fault and we cut it out of her character. We push it aside. There's also total victimhood to her. She is the victim of a prank. As she tries to say at the end, and is actually, I feel a little sympathetic for her. Now, the question kind of becomes, well, did she make a very good decision given that? No, she didn't. Should we fault her for being stupid? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really interesting question. I mean, people do stupid things all the time. They accidentally commit crimes because they're too stupid. And they're still at fault for those crimes. They don't get off just because they're dumb. At the same time, we go back to institutional failure. Should McDonald's be hiring managers who cannot make executive decisions?
Right.
That to the viewer, at least, seem obvious. Probably because they usually don't have to make decisions like this. They make decisions like, what do I do about the pickles? Funny enough, we see her very decisions about even running the business questioned in the beginning of the movie. I think that's the whole point of the mayonnaise mm-hmm. pickle or bacon fiasco.
Right.
The freezer problem is everybody, even the people under her, even the fucking delivery guy goes, you didn't tell the regional manager about the freezer thing yet? Oh, what are you doing here? Come on, get it together. So all we need is a manager who's having an off week or who perhaps isn't, you know, is the smartest person they could find in the region, but not a very bright human individual.
Right.
And we start to see how this could happen. I mean, the movie does try and make it seem as realistic as possible. They invoke the data, you know, in what are those called? Intertitles.
Mm-hmm.
They also give you, I mean, I think they do a great job up front of making that chicken shack seem real. It seems very real. It seems like those are the conversation. That's the way people talk. It's the things they care about, you know, the things that are urgent to them. And the things they talk about in their down moments, the little moments talking about their boyfriends and sexting. But also the stuff that seems immediate. And I love watching people in jobs that most people don't consider to be of importance. Watching the things to them that are in their own context really important.
Mm-hmm.
So like making burgers, right? If somebody makes a burger wrong, I mean, the world's not going to end. You made the burger wrong, you make another one. But to watch how that becomes on the scale of things that you have the power to fuck up that day.
Right. It becomes a 3-point scale.
I know. Right. Yeah. That's exactly what happens. We reset the bar for everything. So when we run out of pickles, it's as if the chicken shack is burning down.
Right.
In some sense, we're all doing that in our lives. Everything seems more important to us for what we do, you know, on a regular basis in our jobs or whatever, than it probably is in the grand scheme. So the movie does a really good job of putting you into that, of going, yeah, this is a real place with real people. And I also think the movie is meant to cross into the line of unbelievable at some point for every member of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
It has to push somebody. I mean, I don't know when this happens for you personally, when the first time you go, come on, really? That really happened? It changes for me. This last time it was the spanking.
Uh-huh.
That's the moment where I'm like, come on, everybody doesn't realize this is...
Right.
How are you going along with this? I mean, do you hit a moment where you go, how do you listen to this guy on the phone and actually do this?
For me, it's go put the clothes in the front seat of your car and leave it unlocked so I can come find it. But don't wait for me.
Yeah, there's certainly that.
I mean,
too.
That to me, I can't imagine any scenario where a cop is like, don't look at me. I have a thing about people looking at me. Just go put it somewhere and I'll go find it.
I also wonder about the fault because of the reactions of the characters. There's a moment specifically I think is really telling in that regard when both the fiance and Becky, you know, are in the room and Sandra comes in and she's naked and they're a lot closer in physical proximity. But when Sandra comes in, they both scramble. Like, you know, you're 13 and your parents are catching you having sex. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah, they bolt to other sides of the room. She scrambles to cover herself. Yeah. He picks up the phone to look like he's not doing anything wrong. It's a very strange reaction to look like you've walked in and caught two people doing something wrong who really don't think at the surface level. They're both there because they think they're obeying a cop, right? I mean,
yeah,
that reaction's really strange to me. It's as if something inside them knows it's a little off or would be embarrassed to see another person watch it. And that scramble kind of says, all right, so there's some doubt in their head somewhere or they know something's amiss. I might be reading too much into a small reaction, but that gets me every time.
I think it's really actually a good point. I mean, I think that Becky, her line of, I knew it was going to happen anyway.
Yeah.
Is a blanket statement for everything that she does. I think she understands that she is in a point of zero authority.
Right.
I mean, I think that's the power of her clothes being in the car, is not only is she in that room without any authority, but she can't walk out.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, she can, but she'll be completely naked.
Oh, that's the end for her. Once she doesn't have clothes, she's trapped there.
Yeah.
I think the actor's name is Drama Walker, who plays her, who just does a fucking phenomenal job. That whole core group, Sandra, Becky, and, you know, Pat Healy. I mean,
right.
All three of those guys. Pat has to be doing something totally different. But Sandra and Becky, you know, the actors playing them, you're so fucking uncomfortable. And everything they're doing, the characters have to read that discomfort because we're watching their react. What we want to know is what's happening in these characters' heads.
Right.
All the audience wants is voiceover that says at all times what they're thinking.
Right.
Because that's the entire catch of what the movie's about. Everybody's watching it going, how the fuck did that happen? What, didn't somebody think something at some point? And so we want to know what these people are thinking. And to watch, you know, Sandra react to a phone call, and the actor playing Sandra, what she's doing is standing in a room on a phone that may not even have anybody on the other line,
right,
in all likelihood, or some simple direction or her lines or who knows what's happening on that line. Maybe nothing. I'm just going to say nothing. She has a prop in her hand. She has nobody else to really react to. She's hearing this stuff that's possibly not even recorded at that point. Who knows? And she has to, her face has to do everything. She has to emote so much so that the audience can read the stress of every line, read her reaction and go, that's a little off. You know, we see Sandra kind of go, oh yeah, that's weird. Mm-hmm. That's a little strange, but also I'm succumbing to the psychological effect.
Right.
I guess I'm going to do this. I kind of feel for Becky, even though I just think she did it. I think she stole the money, but
also keep, you know, in mind,
a person.
Keep in mind the strip search. Sandra is very adamant about Becky saying she's going to do the strip search.
Mm-hmm.
The caller gives Sandra the option and Sandra goes, okay, Becky, listen, do you want to go to the police station? Or, I mean, the strip search would be really easy on you. It would be faster. It'd get it over with. But I mean, whichever one you want to do, do you want to do the strip search?
Yeah, right.
That's the one you'd choose.
But also listen to her parroting those lines.
Right.
Exactly from the caller.
Right.
He sets up the false dichotomy, which coat do you want to wear type scenario.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if we've talked about that on the show before. It was once posed to me as part of child psychology that instead of asking a kid if they want to wear a coat outside, you ask them, do they want, you know, the red coat or the blue coat? And so they feel empowered to make a choice. So he gives that same kind of false, well, we could go. He doesn't even try. He's just, we could go downtown and book her and I wouldn't really want to do that. And she immediately fucking buys it. Oh yeah, we wouldn't. That doesn't sound like a good, they both know there's a second choice coming.
Right.
What's the second option?
Right.
And she just echoes it right back to her. So, you know, seeing Becky be violated through the entire movie, that's a hard job for an actor too. This is all really trying acting stuff. Pat Healy, on the other hand, they're juxtaposing these shots of, you know, there's the macro shot. I love the close-ups of objects in this movie.
Yeah.
The macro shot of folding the clothes up. And, oh, we're going to have to take more clothes. She's not completely naked yet. And fold up her bra, fold up her panties, get the really, really close shots. And then, you know, the next time we're seeing close-up shots, it's Pat Healy making a fucking sandwich.
Right.
It's a really nice kitchen. You know, he's just chomping on a sandwich. This is really funny to him. You almost, I don't want to say you can see Pat Healy's character, you know, the caller. It's not that I understand why he's doing it or think he's right at all. But to him, you can totally get why a human would do this. It's just a joke.
Yeah.
He's not watching the movie Compliance. He's not watching a woman be sexually vandalized in front of a crowd of her peers.
Mm-hmm.
To him, it's a funny gag on a phone. It dehumanizes it a lot. I mean, we don't even have the appropriate amount of time, I think, to dedicate to why a person would do such a fucked up thing. But you see a lot of that in his character and how disconnected he is.
Right.
He's also a little messed up and the person who's the most in the wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But because he's not there to witness it, I think it's a lot easier for these things that have enormous consequence to seem like fleeting jokes to him. Much like Compliance, I think it's time to go and we should just smash cut to resolution.
Okay.
But that's something I like a lot too, is the whole time as you're going, why the fuck doesn't someone something? Once the moment happens where it's realized what's going on, the film bolts into action like nobody's fucking business.
Mm-hmm.
We go immediately to the detective. He gets in the car, comes straight there, and the whole thing is, you know, being resolved way faster than anything right. happens in the film. It's crazy. I want to thank Eric Tocek, Maxwell Harley, Renee Margetson, Enrique, and Lexi Love. They helped bring us the show as executive producers. We have a website, doublefeatureshow.com, and an email address, doublefeatureshow@icloud.com. My Twitter is @_ERICX13.
Yes.
Yours is @PLINGMICHAEL.
Good job.
I'm done. The show's going on too long. What are we doing next time?
Oh, yeah. You want to talk about shows going on too long. Next time is Ye Old Puppet Master Killapalooza. We'll see you next week. We're going to kind of do a comparison on whether or not we disagree on what the full extent of Puppet Master really is.
I just think we can milk it for two shows. But yeah, let's say we disagree on. I think we should do a Puppet Master Killapalooza, have that done, know it's kind of unfinished, and do a Demonic Toys Killapalooza.
But there's not enough Demonic Toys. That's the problem.
All right. Well, I'm going to be lazy and only watch the 10 fucking Puppet Master movies.
I'm going to go ahead and watch all the Puppet Master, all the Demonic Toys, and Doll Man. Because, you know, why the fuck not?
And we'll figure out what we're doing about that next time.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.